This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of February 19th, here are a few top stories. In the news, now that former Representative Don Shooter has been expelled from office, his seat in the Capitol has been filled. But what's next for the legislative district he represented? From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports from the widespread and largely rural LD-13.
Brownie's Cafe in Yuma caters to a lunch crowd that enjoys home-cooked food and a friendly waitstaff. The old-school diner has a long counter where you'll find Mickey Myers sipping coffee. The retiree worked at the Yuma Proving Ground.
Yuma's a good place to live, and we try to elect people that are okay.
That's Myers' response to questions about what happened to his former representative. This is just a few weeks after a detailed report of Shooter's alleged sexual harassment culminated in his removal from office. Myers is careful with his words when it comes to local politics.
People in Yuma are pretty tight-knit, so they stick with him. But they didn't stick with him this last time.
Another Brownie's customer, Pam Ryder, is visiting her friend. She moved from Yuma several years ago, but was just discussing Shooter's situation with her former neighbors.
It's terrible because he's part of this community. However, they both also said that's what really happened. He should not be up there representing us. We need somebody that's honest.
Most refused to speak on the record, saying they don't want to hurt Shooter's family members and their reputation. Many know him personally, and one young man at the cafe was his bartender. They are the type who believe if you have nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. Others still describe Shooter's personality with a choice few words, ones we cannot repeat on the radio. And Myers, who voted for Shooter, sums up his political career like this.
He's done. Stick a fork in him. He's done.
Latent frustration, though, feels just below the surface in the people here who are politically aware. And to understand where that comes from, you have to know the political history of Legislative District 13. Less than a decade ago, a committee redrew the district lines in Yuma County. That essentially cut the region in half. That means the city of Yuma has a different representative than the southern part of Yuma County. And then the committee tacked on much of Phoenix's West Valley to LD-13, which census data show is populated by a different kind of demographic than the Yuma area as far as average income and population density goes. That led to bitterness from people who feel Yuma is often left out of the conversation with other major cities. LD-13 also includes many rural towns like Welton, just outside of Yuma. It's there I meet local farmer John Bolts. We walk along the just-watered rows of green heads, lettuce leaves tickling our ankles. Bolts says it's time someone with rural interests at heart takes up the reins of representing his district.
Rural areas in our state will rarely have equal representation now that Arizona has kind of swung to where the bulk of the population lives in metro areas.
Shooter was retired from real estate and farming when he was elected. Yuma's top issues, Bolts says, are water and immigration, but also spreading knowledge about agriculture.
Some could argue that it's maybe the first and most important thing is what people think about where their food comes from, what people think about rural communities.
Bolts thinks fellow farmer Tim Dunn, the person Yuma County Board of Supervisors chose to replace Shooter, will do a great job of representing those ag interests. For his part, Dunn wants to live up to that promise.
The constituents are very concerned that they make sure they have a voice, that they don't lose out to just votes in the northern part of the district. So it becomes upon me to make sure that I'm able to represent the whole district.
He sits in a sparse office at the Capitol, having only moved in it a week ago. Dunn now serves on the House Transportation, Energy, and Rural Affairs Committees. He says those will keep him busy and are the topics he's most familiar with.
I can engage in and give, I think, support to the chairman and support to those issues right off the bat.
Dunn joins Arizona dairy farmer Sine Kerr in recently filling vacant seats in LD-13. Arizona ag leaders are hopeful this type of representation marks a swing in rural interests having a bigger role in state legislature. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, reporting from Yuma.
Now let's learn a bit about the music we listen to. Here's the show's Mark Brody.
We all have songs we like, and most of us have songs we consider classics. No matter what's going on around us, if we hear it, we turn up the volume and just stop and listen. But why is that? What makes a piece of music great? Rob Capello tries to answer those questions. He's a composer, conductor, author, and commentator, and host of the series What Makes It Great. He's in town this week and came by our studios with keyboard in tow, and I started by asking him, how does he objectively define what's great?
Well, more than what makes it great, what I try to get people to hear is all the things that they would normally miss. You know, music goes by so fast, and there's such fantastic details in the music going by. So a lot of really what the program is listen to this, notice this. So we'll slow something down, I'll play a worse version, change the rhythm, change the harmony, and thereby help people hear things that they otherwise would have missed.
And what do people get out of that, hearing maybe how it could have been or why how it is important?
Well, what it does is it gets you to notice what's really right in front of your nose. I mean, let's take a favorite song that everybody knows. I mean, everyone in the world has known Over the Rainbow since the moment they were born by heart. In fact, none of us can probably even remember a time when we didn't know it by heart. But in fact, it's absolutely a masterful song. So it starts off like this. Everyone knows this music. Now, this opening leap on somewhere, interestingly enough, the first word choices were someday, I'll go over. Then he tried, I'll go over the rim. But finally, he found somewhere. Now, this is a huge leap for a musical theater song, a full octave. In fact, producers thought we shouldn't use this song in the movie because no one will be able to sing it. It's too hard. It's too big a leap. But it's not just a big leap musically. It's a leap between two different parts of the voice, a low voice, hear some, then this high, beautiful voice. But it's also a leap between two different worlds. This low note is Dorothy's troubled reality. It's aridity. It's no flowers. It's the black and white at the beginning of the film. It's Kansas. This note is where she wants to get to. It's Oz. It's Over the Rainbow. It's lighter and more ethereal. Those two notes, Kansas and Oz, are actually the key to a song in a way you won't understand until the last note. There's only two ideas in the song. I call this leap. The other idea I call circle and yearn, because it starts on a note, circles back to it, and then yearns.
Oh.
So we've got leap and circle and yearn. Now, there are three leaps in the opening. A big leap, then one on way up, which is lower, smaller, and then the third one lower on there's a. The leaps are getting smaller, like her dreams, which are poignantly contracting. Huh. Now, we start off with somewhere. Then we've got our circle and yearn. Now, the leap on ways up could have easily been nice and cheery harmony. Way up high. But, you know, great composers don't set words to music. They set the emotion behind the words. So instead of a cheery way up high, it's somewhere. Listen to all the yearning in the piano part. I mean, that's so beautiful.
A little sadness there.
Calls it a song of yearning. It's the harmony underneath. Then there's a could easily have been this. But listen to the one minor chord under there's a. There's a. That dark minor color. Then we finish with two circle and yearns. Circle. Yearn. Circle. Yearn. And we resolve.
When you are looking at songs that you use in your program, do you think that the composer is always meant to do all the things that they do? I mean, was this song intentionally written to have that contrast between the hopes and the dreams and the reality and everything else you just talked about? Or are we sort of projecting?
You mean, am I making this stuff up?
Well, not so much if you're making it up, but like, I mean, are we maybe reading something? Are we reading something that I don't want to say isn't there, but are we maybe giving the composers too much credit?
Well, first of all, as a composer myself, you can never give a composer too much credit. What I would say is the things that I'm pointing out to you in the music are simply the facts of what are there. You know, the way the music descends, the two musical ideas, the way they work, the way the harmony works. Those are simply the facts of the piece, and those are actually in there. What it means is, of course, for all of us to interpret in their own way. But that kind of yearning, I mean, Yip Harburg talked about it. It's a song of yearning. I think a lot of it is embedded. What I'm really trying to focus on is listen to this, listen to this, listen to this chord, could have been this chord. And that stuff is all in there.
It's almost like this is the musical equivalent of what a novelist does. You know, they have their story, but then there are sort of the subtle details that maybe the discerning reader will get, and somebody who's just looking for plot might not understand.
Exactly. And that's what I'm trying to do, is essentially be a good reader. There's a wonderful series, a book by Vladimir Nabokov called Lectures on Literature. And he talks about being a good reader. And he says a good reader is someone who has a conversation with a book, who talks back, who folds down the pages, who underlines, asks questions of the book. And that's what we're really doing in these What Makes It Great programs, is having a conversation with a great piece of music, a conversation with a composer, in which all of a sudden all the things that went by that you might have missed suddenly come alive, and a song that you've known all your life suddenly becomes something different.
This strikes me that it's kind of similar to an app, the name of which I don't remember, where you play a song that you like, and then it gives you other songs that you might like based on that, but it tells you sort of why you like that song. Maybe there's a lot of minor chords, or like the bridge is a certain way. It almost sounds like you're the human version of what this app is trying
to do. Well, I like that I'm the human version of an app, but I would like the payment from the app for being the human version. But yeah, I mean, mostly I'm telling you things that are happening to you that you might not be aware of. It really just comes from paying attention, listen closely, listen to that. For example, that minor chord, you know, has gone by, I'm sure. But, you know, once you notice it, once it's pointed out to you, you can't miss it. Circle and Yearn, once you've pointed it out, you just can't miss it ever again. Once you hear it resolving down here, when it finally, the last time, resolves up here, you'll never hear it the same.
Do you find that when you listen to music, especially music maybe that you haven't broken down this way, do you feel like you hear it differently now since you've been doing this program than you did before?
Well, I think it's the same thing. You know, whenever you learn anything and you become expert at something, it sort of changes the way you look at others. I'm sure a great chef, when he goes to a restaurant, has a different experience with some other chef's food than a normal person. It sort of becomes the way you hear. I'm consciously trying to articulate what I've heard so that you can understand it. But the goal is ultimately it just becomes the way you hear.
What kinds of reactions do you get from people who come to your shows? I mean, do they tell you that they hear it differently? In some cases, maybe do they wish they didn't hear it differently because it's a different emotion than maybe they had associated with the song?
Well, I think, you know, the truth is I try not to focus too much on the emotion, but mostly on what's actually in the song and let them. I mean, today, this is Irresistible in Over the Rainbow. But, you know, if I'm taking a piece of music, mostly I'm trying to show you, listen to this, listen to this, listen to this. They're free to interpret it. I think what mostly I find is people go, wow, I never knew this much was happening in this music. And it's sort of like just going to an art museum. You know, the real inspiration for What Makes It Great for me actually didn't come from music. When I was an undergraduate, I didn't know that much about art. In a way, I was sort of about art the way a lot of people are, say, about classical music. You know, they know a few pieces, they know what they like, but they're not really that knowledge. That's how I was about art. But then I was going out with a girl who was a painter. So I took this art history class. And the first two classes were just, you know, normal classes in a darkened room, slides. But then we would go to the Yale Art Gallery on Friday, and he would take one painting for an hour. And he would just look at one painting. And I realized I didn't know how to look at a painting. It was really a masterclass on the difference between looking and seeing. And so for me, that was the inspiration for What Makes It Great, being about the difference between hearing and listening.
All right. Rob, thanks a lot for coming in. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Rob Capello is a composer, conductor, author, commentator, and host of What Makes It Great. He'll be doing his show tonight at the Musical Instrument Museum and on Thursday night at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Fronteras Desk. Flagstaff is in an affordable housing jam. There are few places to build in a town surrounded by national forest, but the city is also bordered by the Navajo Nation, which has a housing shortage of its own and a large population of homeless. A new Flagstaff housing program is putting many of these people in their own homes. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Lee Nyazi has survived living in her car in Phoenix during the hottest days of the summer.
And constantly turn on the AC, and it was using up my gas. I have the sunshade in front and towels hanging up so nobody won't see me. And I made sure I was close to where I can run to the restroom or Circle K, somewhere where I can, like, wash up.
When her father became sick, she moved to Flagstaff to be near him. He didn't have room for her in his apartment, so she slept in her car again until she found a job. A series of events sent her into a downward spiral. She got hit by a car riding her bike to work and became addicted to alcohol and painkillers. She lost her job and her apartment. A turning point came one night after she overdosed. One of her first steps toward turning her life around was cleaning up her credit and getting her furniture back. So she paid a visit to the landlord who evicted her.
It was heartbreaking. All my stuff was trash. They threw everything in the trash. My pots and pan, my table. Oh, I had a CD collection, too, and my stereo.
Her stuff was gone, but she remained determined to find a new job and home. She was overqualified for the few jobs available, and several weeks passed before she finally landed a payroll specialist position at a new business. Flagstaff's rapid rehousing program set her up with a security deposit at a new place and a case manager who helps keep her housed. So when her landlord handed her a key to her new home, it symbolized something big.
It felt like a whole weight just came off. I felt like, wow, a key. You know? I felt very happy that night when I slept in a bed. I was like, I completely spread out, like, I'm sleeping in a bed.
Yazi, who's Navajo, is one of 700 people in Flagstaff who experience homelessness every day here. 40% are Native American. Ross Altenbaugh is the executive director of Flagstaff Shelter Services and one of the key people who launched this new housing program a year and a half ago.
There are a lot of people with substance issues, especially in a community that's a border town to another community that doesn't allow alcohol.
In addition to bordering the reservation, Flagstaff's a college town where the cost of living is so high it's hard to find a one-bedroom apartment for less than $1,400 a month.
We have a difficult time housing social workers and teachers and police officers. There is an enormous body of people underneath those folks that need housing too that have nothing close to the resources that those folks have.
Some transitional housing shelters spend as much as $25,000 per person per year. The rapid rehousing program costs much less.
Not only is someone like Lean in her permanent house, but it's costing us much less. On average, we're looking at $3,000 to $4,000 per person. So it's a much more cost-efficient intervention, and it has a much higher success rate.
Research backs this idea that a person is more motivated when they have something they stand to lose. 85% have stayed permanently housed after 1 year, and that beats the national average of 67%. Altenbaugh keeps a whiteboard in her office. Every time a case manager helps someone sign a lease, they put that person's name on the board.
It's a little bit like you're ringing the bell when you sell a car. You know, I get mad at my staff if they don't come in and tell me. I'm like, wait a minute, why isn't that name up here? It's a motivator. Like, you walk in and you see that list, and it's like, we need to make sure this person stays housed.
And now, Lean Yazi's name is up there, too.
I feel much better. I feel there's hope. There are times where I felt like I wanted to give up. The times where I cried, and the times where I prayed. I just kept pushing myself.
Now she just has to maintain that. And she says a new home is just the motivation she needs. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
You're listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news,
students at schools across the country walked out of class yesterday in solidarity with teens at a high school in Florida where a mass shooting took place last week. Students participated at a handful of Valley schools, including Mesa High. The walkout started at noon, and hundreds of teens took part. They went to a nearby park where they sang and talked about the shooting that killed 17 people. Cindy Salgado was there.
They were really getting together and supporting each other and telling each other that they really care about each other.
Some students spoke of raising awareness about mental health and gun control. However, Kaylee Grabiel says not everyone who left class was taking a stand.
A lot of kids were doing it, like, to ditch, but me and my group of friends, we did it to honor the people that were lost in Florida.
Others, like Zach Knighting, made a point to stay in class.
All we're doing is we're taking a very real situation and people who actually died, and we're taking a political stance on it, and that's not what we should be doing. What we should be doing is we should be igniting hope in one another and showing each other our love, and that we're strong as a nation, and we will continue to love one another.
At least one more walkout is planned at a Valley High School this week. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Mesa.
And finally, in science news. Citrus is one of Arizona's celebrated five C's. But where did all of those oranges, grapefruits, and limes come from? From the Arizona Science Desk, Nicholas Gerbis reports on an evolutionary journey from the foot of the Himalayas to the neck of a Corona beer bottle.
When life gives you lemons, make lemonade. If life hands you sour orange and citron, make lemons. So says a new genetic analysis in Nature that seeks to clear up citrus's chaotic origin story. By analyzing genomic sequences of 60 citrus varieties, scientists can now trace modern citrus to 10 progenitor species that spread from the southeast foothills of the Himalayas in response to climate change 6 to 8 million years ago. Lead author Albert Wu.
Oranges, lemons, limes, grapefruits, pomelo, yeah. These common varieties, they are all derived from 4 or 5 of these 10 species.
The information could lead to new hybrids with novel flavors or useful qualities like drought tolerance or disease resistance. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.